Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
I'm Joe McCormick.
And I am Christian Sager.
Hey, and all three of us are back in here again to talk about the Ig Nobel Prizes.
Part two.
Yeah, this is part two of a two-part episode. If you haven't checked out the first part, you might want to go back and listen to that first. It was the last episode we did right before this one. But if you want to just jump right in the middle, you don't care about any context, don't want to know what the prizes are, you just want to hear about some weird science, here we are.
Yeah, because it's very modular in that respect. And one study after the other.
And we will definitely be talking about weird science today. We are going to be talking about the science of kissing, the science of how many people, how many babies a man could possibly have in a certain period of time of his life. Bee stings, dinosaur chickens. We're going to be talking about speed bumps and the pain that they apply to us, right?
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, man. But before we get into that, I want to remind our listeners about our social media presence. So Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, we post all kinds of things on those channels that aren't just our podcast, right? We've got our own blog posts. All three of us write for How Stuff Works as well outside of this. And we've got videos as well. Plus, we curate all kinds of weird science that we stumble across throughout the day on the internet. Just yesterday, I found some pretty weird stuff about that there's an exoplanet that apparently rains molten iron. Did you guys hear about this?
Ooh, nice.
Yeah, yeah, so put it up on our Facebook page there.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so if you want to, you know, keep abreast of all the kind of cool, weird, sciencey things that are happening, check us out on there. And don't forget, on Fridays at noon, Eastern Standard Time, we will be on the Periscope to live answer your questions and, you know, chit-chat, give you a little look behind the scenes here at the Stuff to Blow Your Mind headquarters. Also, stufftoblowyourmind.com, that is another place where you can find all of our podcasts, all of our videos, and the amazing blog posts that mainly Robert composes about things from electronic music to monsters and cat buses, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. All that good stuff. All right, so let's jump right back into it here and talk about the 2015 Ig Nobel Prize for Medicine.
Well, that was one of the ones that I looked into.
And it was actually for a collection of four studies. So there were three by one recipient and then one by a different group. And they were all studying the scientific consequences of intense kissing and other intimate interpersonal activity.
Okay. So you can see why. Did they define what the latter was?
Yeah, well, we'll get into that in a minute. But you can see why this appealed to the Ig Nobel committee, obviously, because it involves making out and, and sexy sex.
Tell me more.
Sex. So because there are four of the studies, my attention is going to have to be rather summary on these. But the basics of the first group, and I'm going to try to say their beautiful Slovakian names. I apologize to these people if I pronounce them horribly. But the first group included Yaroslava Durdyakova, Peter Chelich, Natalia Kamodyova, Tatiana Sedlachkova, Gabriela Repiska, Barbara Vizenya, and Gabriel Minarek, and there they are. And they were given the award for their 2012 paper, Prevalence and Persistence of Male DNA Identified in Mixed Saliva Samples After Intense Kissing in Forensic Science International Genetics. So their study was an investigation of how much foreign DNA you could expect to find in a woman's mouth after she'd been participating in some, quote, intense kissing. So here's how the study went. They got 12 pairs of volunteers to try out some of this kissing and see how it goes. And they practiced.
Were the volunteers couples or were they just, you know, I mean,
I think
12 random people?
I think
people.
They were couples, yeah.
Okay.
So they practiced some intense kissing behavior for about 2 minutes. And then afterwards, the scientists collected saliva samples from the women in the couples to look for the presence of male DNA with modern, highly sensitive molecular methods of DNA detection, like multiplex YSTR PCR. I gotta admit, I don't know the first thing about what that is, but I did do a little poking around. It appears to be a real thing.
Okay.
That is a method for detecting the presence of DNA and for sampling it. So the researchers found that they could show the presence of male DNA in female saliva 10 minutes after the intense kissing had stopped, and even up to 60 minutes after the kissing in some cases.
So one thing like I'm inherently curious about right away is, why is it specifically male to female kissing? And is there a difference in homosexual kissing?
I don't know about that, but they did find that they might not be able to say 60 minutes after the kissing was over who the male who was kissing the person was, but they can say this is a male's
DNA. It was male. Okay.
And they are focusing on male DNA in the female mouth and not the reverse.
Right,
right.
The female DNA in the male mouth.
Does that say something
mouth.
About Slovakian French kissing?
Like, well, is it, what's the... in a less funny way, I think it has to do with the potential application of this study, which is that it would be potentially useful in forensic science.
That's what I was thinking, right?
In cases of sexual assault that involved mouth-to-mouth contact. So if a saliva sample can be collected quickly enough, it may contain useful DNA evidence that could be used against the perpetrator of sexual violence.
Gotcha. And you know, it's more likely that those perpetrators are going to be male, so that's probably why they're zeroing in on that.
Yes.
Okay.
This is one of those studies where, to kind of get into the whole why is it ridiculous, why is it funny, it's kind of like a joke that is funny on the surface, and then when you go to explain the joke, you realize that it's actually really serious and kind of dark.
Yeah, but I mean, anything that could help could help bring sexual predators to justice, that's
certainly
a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm kind of fascinated by the way that they're isolating this stuff, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know much about the testing methods that they used, but it seemed to be that they were applying modern, like the best equipment and best procedures that we have today, looking for the presence of DNA to saliva, which was something that hadn't been done yet.
Okay, cool.
But you said
there are more studies,
right? Yeah, that is certainly not all in the kissing and interpersonal contact category, because there are also three studies by Dr. Hajime Kimada, who operates an allergy clinic in the Osaka Prefecture in Japan. And according to an article I read in the Japan Times, Kimada, quote, is continuing to find a more natural method to relieve allergy symptoms for his patients without the use of steroids or prescription skin creams. So, like, he seems to be a guy who's interested in finding ways to help people with bad allergies get some relief without so much drugs and medication.
Okay. But do you guys have bad allergies?
I do, yeah.
Yeah. Not so much.
Yeah, I don't really either. So my wife has very bad allergies, and so I can sympathize with her pain and, mm-hmm. and understand what it is like to be out in the spring and want to, you know, have a full body bubble. What do they call that?
Bubble boy?
Yeah, to live separate from the world of nature. But according to his research, he has found some very promising leads on natural methods for getting some allergy relief. And they involve putting on your copy of Celine Dion's My Heart Will Go On. But it is not the music itself. That is just a means to an end. So I'll briefly mention the reported results of three studies. The first was called Kissing Reduces Allergic Skin Wheel Responses and Plasma Neurotrophin Levels.
Okay.
So here's how it goes. You got three groups. You got 30 normal subjects who are a control group. They don't have any bad allergies. You have 30 people with allergic rhinitis, AR, also known as hay fever or just straight up allergies. When people say, I have allergies, this is what they're talking about.
Yep.
And then you got 30 people with atopic dermatitis, also known as eczema.
Okay.
And of the latter two groups, all the patients are allergic to Japanese cedar pollen and the house dust mite. And Kamada claims that all of the patients, quote, do not kiss habitually. This seemed to be a point he was making. I think it was an assumption about Japanese culture and that like kissing is at least believed to be not as prevalent in Japanese culture as it is in lots of other cultures. I don't know the extent to which that's true today.
Mm.
But that seemed to be an assumption going into his research. That may well be true.
That seems to match up with some materials I've researched in the past. I mean, it gets kind of complicated because you have all of these varying cultures and kissing traditions. And there's a certain amount of universality, but then there's not in some areas. And then you have Western culture rolling into these areas, and you have Western ideals and images of individuals engaging in these passionate kisses, and that changes everything.
Yeah. So that was what he said, at least. They do not kiss habitually.
And he's Japanese.
Yes, he is. And so the subjects went into a room with their kissing partner of choice, and they, quote, kissed freely for 30 minutes while listening to soft music.
Wow.
And
then
the patients underwent the standard allergist skin prick test. Y'all ever done these?
I have, yeah.
Prick your skin to see if you get a wheel response, raised red area.
When they did mine, they did like the whole part of my upper left arm and then all across the upper part of my back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then they basically prick you with the thing that you're allergic to, and a wheel will rise if you
like
are.
They come in and they have a crab claw and they jab that in your arm, and then they get some
that would be
thorn
great.
Bush and they start
it's just like a cockroach. They're just smashing a cockroach into your arm.
Pelting them across.
Oh,
the
crab claw if you're for shellfish.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right in the arm.
Yeah, so they got the standard skin wheel response test, the skin prick test before and after the kissing sessions.
Okay.
And Kamada claims that the half hour of kissing, quote, significantly reduced wheel responses. For both the dust mite allergen and the Japanese cedar pollen allergen. And though it did not reduce responses for the pure inflammatory agent histamine. So if you just gave people histamine directly, the kissing did not help.
Well, this makes sense, right? Because you're mingling your immune systems a little bit. You're mingling your microbiomes. So
maybe
it seems like one would rub off on the other. You'd have some of the soldiers would take up with the new.
Well, party. I guess
I don't know if I should be surprised by this or not.
I'm kind of curious, since they gave the test before and after, if they just gave it before and then did nothing, and like they didn't make out, and then they gave it to them again afterwards, if they would still have the same results.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's an interesting question.
Because you're getting an exposure in your system already, right? And then 30 minutes go by, and then that you're exposed and tested again.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder just how much naturally your body would react less to the inflammation.
Yeah. After the end of that, Kamada concluded that kissing, quote, might have some implication in the study of neuroimmunology in allergic patients. And then there were a couple more studies that were pretty much along the same lines. The second one was called Reduction of Allergic Skin Wheel Responses by Sexual Intercourse in Allergic
Patients. This guy is like the mad scientist. he's just coming up with reasons so he can watch people make out and have sex.
Oh, I don't think he was watching.
Oh, but then clearly the data is erroneous.
The study found almost exactly the same thing, except replace 30 minutes of kissing with some sexual intercourse. In allergic people, it reduced skin wheal responses for Japanese cedar pollen and dust mites, but not for pure histamine, so the same pattern as the other one. And in normal, non-allergic people, sex didn't change anything about skin wheal responses.
Okay.
So there you got it.
What's Dr. Creepy's third study?
The third one, it's pretty much along the same lines. It's kissing selectively decreases allergen-specific IgE production in atopic patients. Again, this is looking at like skin responses like eczema. And he found essentially that kissing could alleviate some allergic symptoms by the decrease of what he calls allergen-specific IgE production.
Okay.
So basically the thrust of this guy's work in this area is that kissing and other intimate interpersonal contact may help with your allergies.
Okay. All right. Well, next time I'm having problems, I guess I'll have to address that with my wife, but rather than take a loratadine or whatever it is that I mean, take on a regular basis or use my name.
I wonder how many minutes of kissing it takes. And
30 at least.
Apparently. Well, no, maybe it would have been the same with 10 minutes of kissing.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
And so, okay, so if it takes like 30 minutes of kissing, are there some people who'd be like, 30 minutes of kissing? I don't have time for that.
Yeah,
I'll just
seriously.
Take the drugs.
That's work. Yeah, exactly. Right. That's a great,
I don't know.
That's a great commercial for like an antihistamine. It's just like, do you really have time to kiss someone for 30 minutes, or would you just like to drink this NyQuil or whatever?
Yeah, I'll never sleep again.
Well, this study makes a great segue. I see now why the Ig Nobel committee put these next to one another. Nice transition segue into the mathematics prize, which is all about a guy named Mule Ismail the Bloodthirsty, who I had not heard of before this.
No, I was not familiar with this character either. I mean, he sounds impressive.
Well, was he thirsty for blood?
He was indeed, and I will tell you all about him. The paper itself was written by E. Obernzocker and K. Grammer in 2014, and the study is called The Case of Mule Ismail, Fact or Fancy. And this was also in PLOS-1. Okay, the basics here are that these researchers developed a computer simulation program to determine if the myth of Mule Ismail having actually sired 888 children as per the Guinness Book of World Records was true. So the Guinness Book of World Records says he sired 888 children. These people want to find out if it's even physically possible for him to do that. They found that he could. And not only that, but he could have much more than 888 children during his lifetime.
So he's really an underachiever, is what they're
saying. Well, actually, no, it turns out that there's reports that he had more. They also narrowed down how many times a day he would have to copulate and how many women would need to be part of his harem for this whole operation to work.
Wow.
And they used different models. The first model was a random mating pool where he had unrestricted access to women. The second model, though, it was a, quote, restricted harem pool in which basically they took account for as women got pregnant, they would be removed from the harem for at least 18 months to account for their pregnancy and lactation times. And then they used three different models for looking at the likelihood of conception across the female cycle. That's their phrasing, not mine. But basically the idea is they based these models on different conditions in which ovulation might happen, or like whether or not the sperm would be potent, or whether or not there were birth control methods somehow being enacted here, right? So the three models that they used are the Wilcox-Weinberg model, the Barrett-Marshall model, and then the Joshiel, I believe, model. And they found with these three models that roughly it would take 1.43 times per day with the first one, 1.63 times per day with the second one, and only 0.83 times of copulation per day with the third one. So they took into account things like menstruation being a taboo, or there's an idea that's been reported on in other research that people are more attracted to one another during ovulation periods. And of course, the viability of his sperm decreasing per year as he got older. They added all this stuff into their computer simulation model. And even when restricted to the second model, they found that he would be able to sire the fabled number of offspring. In fact, he would be able to sire at least 1,171 children. And that his harem, even though it was reported to be 504 women strong, it wouldn't need to be much larger than somewhere between 65 to 110 women for him to achieve this. It might have been that he actually did have a harem that was 500 people, but that was for other reasons. Potentially he wanted to keep women out of the reach of other men and their reproductive potential, right? So that he was fathering the next generation. It was probably rare, they also found, for each woman in the harem to have had intercourse with him more than once, because of the large amount of women that were in the harem. So, you know, you essentially have intercourse with him, you get pregnant, you have a child, there's a lactation period, and then when the concubines within the harem reached the age of 30, they were kicked out isn't the right word, but they weren't part of the harem anymore. He didn't want anybody over the age of 30 in his harem.
Wow.
Yeah. I haven't even gotten to why they call him the bloodthirsty yet. This is just all about his sexual conquests.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astaproallergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
So, Sheriff Ayan, he's referred to as the Sheriff Ayan, Emperor of Morocco, Moulay Ismail the Bloodthirsty. He was in power from 1672 to 1727 and became emperor when he was 25. So, he was the first great sultan of the Moroccan Alawite dynasty, okay? And Sherifian means that he claimed to be descended from Muhammad, the founder of Islam. His rule was the longest in Moroccan history, and toward the end, he had an army of 150,000 men. He supposedly started his reign by mounting the heads of 400 enemy chiefs at the city of Fez. Over 55 years, he's estimated to have killed 30,000 people, and that's not including those in battle. This is just at his whimsy, he killed 30,000 people.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and I'll give you some examples of that. Any women who were suspected of adultery were strangled personally by him. So any of his concubines or any of his wives who he suspected, he strangled them. Or their breasts were cut off, or their teeth were torn out.
Whoa.
This included former concubines. So even if you hit the age of 30 and were allowed to leave the harem, you were still not allowed to have intercourse with any other man. So he, you know, committed violence against all these women.
He's just a real winner.
Oh, yeah. He's a real cheery individual. Any man who looked at one of his wives, he had four wives and then the 500 concubines, but any man who looked at the wives or the concubines were punished by the death penalty. I don't think he physically did it himself as he did with the women, but he was bloodthirsty, as the name, you know, implies.
That's messed up.
So they looked at this report, the researchers, that was written by a French diplomat named Dominique Busnot from 1704. And at the time he was visiting, he said that Moulay had 600 sons with his four wives and 500 concubines. However, only the daughters from his four wives were allowed to live. Those from the concubines were suffocated by the midwives at birth. So he only wanted male offspring from the concubines. In total, even, you know, including all of the children that were, you know, supposedly suffocated by these midwives, that comes down to 1,171 children in the span of 32 years. So why is it ridiculous? Well, you know, what do we learn from confirming this legend about this man's sexual prowess, right? That seems pretty weird that they spent all this time looking into this.
Right? Yeah. Well, I mean, as nasty and sensational and cruel as the details of the story are, I mean, I guess it could be actually interesting from just a mathematics of studying population generation perspective. Yeah. Like, if you want to look at how animal populations reproduce themselves under certain constraints like this one, it might be useful to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, or some, like, sort of like last man on earth scenario or repopulating a world.
Exactly it, that they, you know, there's value to this. It's important because they're trying to figure out, you know, given a certain scenario, you know, where there's only one man who can potentially do this, like why the last man quite type scenario.
You know where actually I feel like this could be useful would be in trying to deal with endangered species.
If you
have a species in captivity where you may only have like one reproducing male or something like
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so for comparison, Genghis Khan is another one that's sort of fabled to have had many sexual encounters and subsequent offspring. He had so many offspring in the 13th century that 8% of the men that live currently in the region of his former empire carry almost identical Y chromosomes to his. And they've figured out that that's 16 million descendants. So you can see now, you know, why trying to do the math on this and essentially developing this program so they can map this out is important so that you can figure out sort of genealogy.
Right. So it is actually telling us something about how the world works, not just about the particulars of this one really nasty guy in history.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, like, yes, like the historical narrative of him is, you know, brutal and sad.
Yeah, I had to look him up when you were talking just to, in the hope that he had a satisfying death for me.
Oh,
he got his comeuppance.
But did he?
He just died at 80. I didn't see any mention of assassins slicing him to pieces.
I believe, I may be wrong about this, but I believe that his dynasty and his descendants are still in power in Morocco. So he's the, you know, progenitor of this dynasty, essentially.
Whoa.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like real life Game of Thrones. Awful individual.
I kept thinking about Game of Thrones while I was reading this. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But, you know, they've got these three different models in this computer program now so that they can apply that to, you know, various other circumstances. And if we're in a circumstance where there's only one man left alive, we know who to turn to find out how many children they can have to keep the human race going.
All right. Well, let's move on to the next one. This one is the 2015 Ig Nobel Prize in Biology. And this one was a lot of fun to look into. The actual paper is Walking Like Dinosaurs. Chickens with Artificial Tails Provide Clues About Non-Avian Theropod Locomotion by Bruno Grassi, Jose Irate Diaz, Omar Larach, Mercurio Canales, and Rodrigo A. Vasquez. And this was published in PLOS 1, 2014. So the basics here. If you want to study dinosaur biology, outside of looking at fossil remains, modern birds are a great study aid.
Okay.
Because, of course, birds are pretty much the modern dinosaur, right?
Sure.
We can see the direct lineage, the evolution. However, a lot has changed with the basic anatomy since the age of the dinosaurs. For instance, living birds maintain an unusually a crouched hind limb posture and locomotion powered by knee flexion. Meanwhile, we generally infer that non-avian theropods from the dinosaur age kept a more upright posture and that their limb movement was powered by femur retraction. So
I'm thinking velociraptors from Jurassic Park.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, similar build.
Because that is known for its scientific accuracy, by the way.
Yeah. So we're talking similar build, but we're talking, you know, different ways of motion and ultimately different center of mass. And so in this particular joint U.S.-Chilean study, the researchers set out to, quote, experimentally manipulate the location of the center of mass in living birds.
Mm.
And what better way to do that than to raise some chickens with artificial tails stuck to their bums? And it's key here that they had the artificial tail during key growth phases. So they would stuck it on early, and they kept having to change it up as the bird grew.
So for our audience, in the notes, Robert has inserted a picture of Donald Duck with a plunger on his butt.
Yes, and I can't remember exactly which Disney cartoon this is from, but it instantly came to my mind, and it matches up pretty perfectly with what they actually did.
Yeah.
Because the tail in the experiment was a
did loose. They make them wear little sailor outfits too?
Sadly not.
Okay.
Sadly not. But I mean, but they did have an elastic fabric coat with Velcro fasteners to hold this on, because essentially the tail was a wooden stick set in a clay molding base that was then held on with Velcro and elastic. And they replaced it every 5 days as the chickens grew.
Okay.
But yeah, if you remember Donald Duck with a plunger on his butt, that's exactly what this consisted of. So what this accomplished is that it effectively moved the chicken's center of mass towards the posterior.
Mm-hmm.
And the chickens did, in fact, demonstrate, quote, a more vertical orientation of the femur during standing and increased femoral displacement during locomotion. So I'd have to go back and rewatch that Disney cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm assuming Donald Duck did not walk differently, that his gait didn't change, his center of mass didn't change in the cartoon based on the plunger, but this experiment proves that he would have.
Mm. This is not all that far away from the research that we were looking at last week on the podcast about why certain early humans had short legs.
Oh, yeah.
Because it enabled their center of gravity to be better for fighting and grappling.
Yeah, yeah, it's very, very much just about just how the creature's position and ultimately what the creature is doing.
Mm-hmm.
A chicken, a modern, you know, domesticated chicken versus this ancient creature. So Why is it funny? Of course, chickens are inherently funny. We all know that. Just the sound of the chicken is funny. And sticking the plunger on one's butt, even funnier, especially if it's ultimately about exploring dinosaurs, which are generally not inherently funny, but, you know, inherently cool.
Do you think there's ever a point with the research in the Ig Nobel Prizes where the researchers kind of sat back one afternoon and they said, all right, let's stick a plunger on a chicken's butt. That's essentially what they did.
And then find a reason.
And then from there, work our way back to write an academic paper about this.
So that it gets into a peer-reviewed scientific journal justification of the plunger on the butt.
Yeah. I like the idea of the researchers, like, after it's after it's published and they're feeling proud of their work, they end up seeing some Disney cartoons on TV.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh my God, that's where that came
from. That's anatomically inaccurate.
No, I believe them. I believe that, that this was done in good faith and for good scientific reasons.
Yeah.
And it ultimately helps us understand the anatomy of these ancient creatures and help us better understand the evolution that's taken place with this form. And they also point out that through careful phenotypic manipulation of our modern birds, we can actually, quote, open new avenues of experimental investigation into unexplored facets of dinosaur locomotor mechanics and energetics. So
unless I'm misunderstanding that, they're saying we can genetically engineer birds to turn back into dinosaurs.
That's some research that's been on the table for a while, that there are various ways you can sort of turn various genetic and epigenetic traits on and off and harken back to earlier morphological modes.
I learned in Jurassic World, these have military possibilities. You could send in a pack of these genetically modified birds and to take out some enemies of the state.
So I have a question for you guys. Mm. It always happens in the movies that the military is interested in the creation of monsters that kill people.
Yeah.
Has there ever been a real military experiment in creating monsters that kill people?
To a certain extent, you can look at various projects that involved using animals as explosive delivery devices. Are you also using animals as spy devices?
That's true. Yeah, you got your spy pigeons. You got your dog that runs under a tank with a bomb on its back. Yeah. But I mean, like, giant scorpions.
This sounds like...
You get into some sort of gray areas here. You know, in terms of how much of this is actually, is there any truth to it, and how much of it is just hearsay and mythology?
Right.
You do see some, and this is a whole separate podcast, but you do see some arguments that the Soviets were interested in creating some sort of a man-ape, hybrid that would have probably, if you give those stories any credence, they would have probably been used for labor. And I'm not sure I give those stories any credence.
I feel like this is something we need to do some more research and tackle for an episode. It sounds like
all the best movies begin with a creature that's designed by the military as a weapon, but then gets loose on an airplane.
Yeah. Species.
Species, it's an alien.
Don't they get it from it's like an alien code, but the military are the ones who are developing it, I think.
Oh man, that movie. Ugh. Yeah. But anyway, getting back to the study with the chicken with the plunger on its butt, I do think, I don't know, it's interesting because having great movies like Jurassic Park and stuff, we can forget that we've never actually seen a dinosaur move.
Because
the movies are so good and they stick in the mind, we think we've seen what it's like for a Tyrannosaurus Rex to walk, but we haven't. We don't know what it would be like.
We've seen those illustrations. We've seen representations of how we think they move. But again, all of that is based on looking at the fossil remains, comparing those to existing creatures. And this is an experiment that kind of bridges the gap between the two.
Yeah. Hey, so I think it's time to take a quick break to hear about our sponsor for this episode, but after that, we're going to come right back and talk about more weird science.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Okay, well, I think if it's time to talk about the next award, this next one was the prize given in physiology and entomology. So that's kind of a weird mixture. Mm-hmm. The study of the body and study of insects. And the essential unifying factor here is insect stings, stinging insects and the pain they inflict.
Okay.
So there were two different recipients for different studies on this award. It was Dr. Justin O. Schmidt was the first one, and then also Michael L. Smith. So Schmidt is an American entomologist who's been studying stinging insects like wasps, ants, bees for decades, a long time. And over the course of his career, he's been stung a lot. He's been stung just inadvertently. It happens. I think there are some people who have reported that he set out intentionally to get himself stung by 1,000 different insects, and that's not necessarily true. But over the course of his career, he has been inadvertently stung more than 1,000 times, and he's ranked the stings of dozens of insects. The last figure I saw was 78 different insect species by the level of pain inflicted by the sting.
So this is purely subjective based on his experience of the stings.
Yes, both okay. of these studies are going to be inherently subjective, but at the same time, mm-hmm. I think useful because, I mean, there are lots of phenomena we study that are inherently subjective.
Well, but pain itself is difficult to classify in this regard.
Yeah, they're inherently...
Pain, you don't know the meaning of the word.
Right. They're inherently subjective, but you can see trends emerge. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you have a bunch of people rate pain, you'll eventually discover that it does actually hurt more on average to get hit in the head with a hammer than it does to get flicked in the cheek or something.
Okay. Right. Yeah.
But anyway, the scale. He created a scale that's known as the Schmidt Sting Pain Index. And so the scale goes from 0 to 4. A 0 is no effect at all. A 1 is kind of a small little spark of pain, like a sweat bee or
gotcha.
Something.
Yeah.
A 2 is going to be for a common sting like the sting of a honeybee, of Apis mellifera. A 3 is a more kind of intense, powerful really troubling pain, and there are a bunch of insects he lists that can give stings like that. And then a four is just melt your brain pain. Mm-hmm. An example of level four is the tropical bullet ant, Paraponera clavata,
okay,
which is pain that it's been described in a lot of ways. I want to sort of summarize the things I've read about it by saying it's like having a hot nail shoved into your bones, and the pain lasts for 24 hours.
All right.
There is, in fact,
speaking of animals that we could utilize for military purposes.
Oh, yeah. Bullet ants, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Make some giant bullet ants.
Also around four is the tarantula hawk, which you can actually run into in the United States, I think, in the Southwest.
Really?
And this stuff is like, if it stings you, it's just unbearable. It's
but not lethal, right?
Right.
Okay.
Well, I don't know if it's impossible for it to be lethal, but I haven't read anything about it being lethal.
Okay.
It's, I mean, at least not regularly.
Yeah, not to a person who doesn't have an existing allergic reaction.
Right.
Yeah. And so there's actually, if you want to read it, there are plenty of places out on the internet where the Schmidt sting pain scale has been supplemented with these kind of wine tasting style descriptions that originally came out of an article that he gave some quotes to in the 1990s. And it's pretty funny. I'm not going to read through all of them here, but it would be like, oh, sort of like light fruity pain.
It had a flutter of strawberries.
Right.
Like, what's that movie, Sideways?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, I can imagine a future where you'll have the human race, it's so jaded by pleasurable sensations that they do have to explore.
It's the Cenobites, exploring the limits of pleasure and pain intertwined. But anyways, Schmidt first published a version of his sting pain index in the 1983 paper, Hemolytic Activities of Stinging Insect Venoms, in the journal Insect Biochemistry and Physiology. And he has since expanded and refined his scale in some subsequent publications. And so now it's pretty big. You know, it's got at least 78 insects. He may have added more since then.
Mm-hmm.
But while there is some inherent subjectivity to this, I think it's interesting that it's useful to have ways of characterizing the levels of inflicted pain by different insects so that we can study things like insect venom and its effects. If you don't have something like a sting pain scale, how do you begin to study the relationship between like venom compounds and sting pain?
Or treatment.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, leading to treatment studies, yeah.
But one of the things that Schmidt had acknowledged in some of his earlier work is that different sting locations on the body will make a difference, but he didn't try to formulate a scale to reflect that, you know, the map of pain
right
across the body. Well, in 2014...
That's my new horror story, Map of Pain.
Oh, no, it makes me think about Jeffrey Combs and The Frighteners. You know, my body is a road map of pain. But in 2014, a Cornell graduate student in neurobiology and behavior named Michael L. Smith published a paper exploring this theme, which it was a different variable on the same question. So instead of measuring the relative pain experience of stings inflicted by different insects, he decided to measure the difference of pain inflicted by the same insect stinging different places on the body.
Okay.
On himself.
Okay.
So Smith had been studying honeybee behavior and evolution, mm-hmm. and according to an interview he gave to National Geographic, he was inspired to do this experiment after a bee flew up his shorts and stung him in the testicles.
That would definitely be an inspiring situation.
Moment of silence for Michael L. Smith and his testicles.
Yeah, so the paper it doesn't stop there, because the paper he wrote is called Honeybee Sting Pain Index by Body Location.
Mm.
You can read the full text online. It's available for free, and it's certainly not going to win an award for like the most rigorous methodology in the world, because the number of subjects is one, the author himself,
mm-hmm.
and the reporting is inherently subjective, as we've been talking about. All of this admitted in good humor by the author. It's not like he's trying to make a bigger deal of it than
right.
it is.
Yeah.
But it is a pretty fun read if you're interested in some dry humor. A great example is in his methods section. He says, Cornell University's Human Research Protection Program does not have a policy regarding researcher self-experimentation, so this research was not subject to review from their offices. The methods do not conflict with the Helsinki Declaration of 1975, revised in 1983. The author was the only person stung, was aware of all associated risks therein, gave his consent, and is aware that these results will be made public.
Yeah.
Okay.
So his method was pretty interesting. The research was carried out in 2012, and Smith picked 25 different locations on the body to test with the standard stimulus of a honeybee sting. And the honeybee sting is a good choice for a standard stimulus because it's right in the middle of the Schmidt scale. You remember
it goes from 0 to 4. That's like a 2.
Yeah, so it's right in the middle. It hurts. But it's not blinding pain.
Okay.
I'm guessing it's also easy to control the number of stings.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's true also. And it's a familiar reference point for many people in the world. A lot of people have been stung by honeybees. Mm-hmm. So during the test, Smith goaded bees to sting him 5 times every day, always between 9 a.m. and 10 a.m. to avoid the sort of pain perception variance that could be related to time of day. It's possible that you might feel more pain in the evening or something.
Gotcha.
So between 9 and 10.
Sorry, back up for a second. Why would that be? Because of like
it just
weather
could be. He just
pressure.
Wanted, he just oh, wanted okay. to eliminate that
oh,
variable.
Oh, so he just had a, yeah. Okay, gotcha.
So it's always between 9 and 10 a.m. He'd get stung 5 times, and the sting session would start with a calibration sting on the forearm, which he used as his internal standard. He gave the forearm sting a 5.0 pain rating out of 10. And so that's right in the middle. So all of the mm-hmm. other stings were rated relative to what it feels like to get stung right on the forearm by a honeybee. Is it worse? Is it not as bad? And then he rated the test locations relative to that. And then he would sting himself 3 times in various test locations with a calibration sting before and after on the forearm.
So I have a question.
Yeah.
How do you goad the bees to sting you in specific ways?
Oh, I'm getting to that part.
Okay.
In fact, just let me read you a quote straight
from
his materials. Quote, bees were taken from the cage haphazardly with forceps. To apply the sting, the bee was grabbed by the wings and pressed against the desired sting location. The bee was held against the sting location until the sting was first felt and kept at the location for 5 seconds to ensure that the stinger would penetrate the skin. The bee was pulled away after 5 seconds, leaving the stinger in the skin. The stinger was left in the skin for 1 minute and then removed with forceps.
Well, okay.
So he just pinned a bee
him. He thought it out.
And then he made a roadmap of pain.
Oh, we're looking at the map of pain now.
Yeah, so it marks all the places on the body where he stung himself, and it's pretty funny to imagine how he got the bee to sting him, for example, on the buttocks and the back of the neck. There must have been some kind of...
He must have had help, right? He probably had like an intern.
I don't know. He didn't say anything about that.
No? Okay.
But anyway, he found some results. So out of the 25 places, he found that the least painful places to get stung were the skull,
mm-hmm.
the middle toe tip, and the upper arm.
That's interesting, because I would have thought the buttock for some reason, you know? I mean, that seems like a great area to take it.
And then he found that the 3 most painful locations were the nostril, the upper lip, and the penis shaft.
Okay.
Which got a 9.0 out of 10 for the nostril, an 8.7 for the upper lip, and a 7.3 for the penis shaft.
Wow, I wouldn't have thought about the nostril being that bad. But,
yeah, I'm going to get to the nostril in a minute. So Smith found that for him, a few things were interestingly ruled out. He found that the side of the body was not a significant factor in pain perception. So left or right doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
He found that the date of stinging did not matter. And the order of stinging per round did not matter. The most significant factor in pain variation was, as predicted, the location of the sting. So in short, it doesn't much matter whether you get stung on Wednesday and Thursday. It matters if you get stung on the knee or on the nipple.
Okay.
And so I wanted to do a little test and see if you guys can guess the following without looking.
Okay.
So I'm gonna give you 3 places to get stung and see if you can rank them in order of least painful to most painful.
Okay.
Okay. Upper thigh, foot arch, so the instep, the sole of your foot mm-hmm. arch, and behind the ear.
Oh.
Hmm.
I would Do you want us both to do it?
Yeah.
I would say arch as of the foot is worse, and then behind the ear, and then thigh.
Yeah, I'm kind of going based on people I know who've had tattoos done in those areas and how much pain they experience. And so I think it's going to be behind the ear, foot arch, and then the thigh at the end.
No, so they were all pretty close, but it was actually in the order I said. The least painful was the upper thigh.
Right.
The second most painful was the foot arch, and then the most painful was behind the ear.
Okay, that's the order that you said.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I meant I just was doing it in reverse order.
Oh, sorry, yeah. So that's 4.7, 5.0, and 5.3, respectively. All pretty close.
Not kind of in the middle there, huh?
Yeah.
Huh.
Not very far off. Now, I got three more for you. See if you can do these. Scrotum, buttock, nipple.
Okay, from least to most, I've got to go buttock, nipple, scrotum.
Would you agree, Christian?
No. Least to worst, buttock, scrotum, nipple for me.
Okay, Robert was right. It goes buttock, nipple, scrotum. Though nipple and scrotum are very close. Mm-hmm. The scrotum was a 7.0 out of 10, the nipple 6.7, and the buttock 3.7.
Okay.
He points out also in the paper that this is limited by also male anatomy, so he's having stings on locations that a woman couldn't get stung on.
I'm curious about the gender applications here.
And he
couldn't convince any of his female colleagues to...
He couldn't convince anybody, apparently. I don't know if he tried.
Yeah, but this is the kind of study where you might realize... I'm the only one who's going to be game for this.
Well, you know, as he kind of pointed out, like it would probably introduce complications with ethics review if he was trying to get other people to submit to this. So he just did it to himself. And in the spirit of science, I think it's interesting what he found. Why it's ridiculous, that's fairly obvious, because it involves grabbing bees with tweezers and pressing them against your nipples until they attack.
I kind of wish, and I don't know, like, maybe he did, maybe he didn't, but he was, like, documenting the whole thing, and that there's just, like 20 years from now, this series of photos is going to come out of him, like, with the forceps applying them in various areas.
Or the audio. I would just...
Oh, yeah, that'd be good, too.
That's
just a whole podcast on its own. Just getting stung by bees in different areas and listening to people yell in pain.
So I think that this actually is, believe it or not, despite the small sample size and the subjective nature of it, I do think it's interesting research.
Yeah.
Both the Schmidt Sting Pain Index and the subsequent body roadmap of pain, because they're certainly not as objective as like taking your temperature with a thermometer or measuring your white cell count or something, but they're important for helping us characterize the relationship between insects' venoms and the subjective sensations they produce. It would be more useful in the future probably to repeat these same types of experiments just with larger sample sizes, just get more people to get stung and report how much pain they felt. But again, that presents an experimental problem. It's hard to get an experiment like that done.
Ethically. Yeah. But if you combine Schmidt's research, his pain index, and this, you get like a fairly interesting roadmap of pain.
Yeah.
Ultimately, I mean, that's what it's about. Yeah. You're mapping an unmapped area, which kind of goes back to the slime mold analogy I made for science.
What if it was scorpions?
Oh, I don't know.
Maybe that's his next project.
Well, this is like the
jackass of academic studies.
Yeah, getting like hit in the face.
Yeah, like Johnny Knoxville publishes in PLOS 1. like this is what happens when you jump off a trampoline when you're naked into a pit of snakes.
I don't think they'd do the snakes.
No.
No. They do a bed of
nails.
Yeah. Anyway, though, another interesting takeaway from this was not just about the venom and the sting pain, but about human responses.
Okay.
So one of the things that Smith pointed out in his research was that it's kind of weird how the most painful sting of all of them was a sting to the nostril.
Mm. Yeah.
He says that it was the especially violent. It was a 9.0 out of 10. He really did not want to repeat that one, though he knew he had to for the experiment, and he was not looking forward to it. But he said that the nostril stings were especially violent, immediately inducing sneezing, tears, and a copious flow of mucus.
Mm.
And then he also points
out that makes sense.
Yeah.
That your nerve endings are probably fairly sensitive.
Yeah. And he says the sting did autotomize in the nostril, meaning it cut itself off. So the stinger gets separated.
Mm-hmm.
And then the bee is removed, but the stinger stays in. And he mentions that the copious flow of mucus, however, may help prevent subsequent stings to the area during a natural attack.
Yeah.
So that's something that we might now understand better about humans in this scenario, where if you're actually getting stung by bees in the wild, putting all this mucus out might prevent more bees from stinging you in that place.
Huh. That's a good idea. Yeah.
I think it requires further research.
By some brave or foolish individual.
Well, so anyway, I very much enjoyed reading about that, and I hope that there is at least one more study about pain.
Oh, there is. Yes, our final study here is the 2015 Ig Nobel Prize for Diagnostic Medicine, and it deals entirely with speed bumps and appendicitis. So the actual, and this is, I was really fascinated by this because I have not suffered appendicitis. I have not had my appendix out. So I can't directly relate to the pain, and and kind of like their last statement, I'm having to just go on these subjective accounts of what that pain is like. The paper in question here is pain over speed bumps in diagnosis of acute appendicitis, : diagnostic accuracy study. And this is from Helen F. Ashdown, Nigel DeSosa, Delilah Karam, Richard J. Stevens, Andrew Huang, and Anthony Harnden, and these are all researchers from the University of Oxford and Stoke Mandeville Hospital. Okay, so here's the basic deal. You have acute appendicitis, all right, and this is actually the most common surgical abdominal emergency.
Mm-hmm.
And rapid diagnosis of appendicitis is critical because the more time that passes between diagnosis and surgical treatment, the greater the risk for complications and even death.
Yeah, you got to get it fixed quick.
Right. And then this is where it gets trickier. There's no specific clinical diagnostic test for appendicitis. We don't have a device that you can point at the body. There's not a blood test. All of it has to depend. It just depends on the doctor talking to somebody, getting their subjective feedback about the pain they're experiencing.
Okay.
And then the doctor has to make a call. Do we cut them open? Do we not cut them open?
Right.
Do we perform the surgery? Do we not? And as a result, the rate of negative appendectomy, that's surgery performed on a healthy appendix, ranges from 4% to 42%.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So clinical diagnosis, especially that early diagnosis, can be challenging.
Yeah.
Because you want to catch it early, but if it's early, it's going to be harder to determine if that's actually what's going on. And you don't want to remove a healthy appendix. You don't want to perform unnecessary surgery on people for a variety of reasons. So one possibility emerges here, and that is the role of speed bumps. Because as it turns out,
literal speed bumps. On the road.
Lumps of asphalt that make your car, your truck, or bus go blah, 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 up and down.
Okay.
Because as it turns out, individuals coming into the hospital for appendicitis or suspected appendicitis often find those speed bumps really painful to go over.
And emergency rooms have lots of speed bumps in front of them, usually.
Yeah.
I think so. That would make sense.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like the no-wake sign of the hospital. You don't want people zooming around.
Yeah.
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 So as it turns out, some doctors actually incorporate this into their diagnostics.
Huh.
When asking somebody about their pain, trying to determine if they have appendicitis, they might ask them, well, what was it like going over the speed bump or the series of speed bumps coming into the hospital?
Yeah.
So
that's why those speed bumps are there, solely to diagnose appendicitis.
Well, it makes you, in this study, will I think ultimately make you think that any hospital that doesn't have speed bumps needs them. Because what they did is they decided to look into this, right, to see if there's any actual validity to doctors asking about this. Should all doctors ask about speed bumps and abdominal pain? So
This is a really fun paper. I'm not going to read the whole intro, but I also really love that it has one of these very clinical intros that defines what a speed bump is and why we have them. The study itself examined 101 patients who were referred to the hospital for suspected appendicitis. Testing took place in 2012, and patients were between 17 and 76 years of age. Patients were classed as speed bump positive if they had a worsening of pain while traveling over the speed bumps. Okay. And they were classified as speed bump negative if their pain stayed the same, if they were unsure, or if their pain improved.
Wait a second. Pain people improved. Who are like,
I feel better.
Put me back on the speed bump.
Back up for a second.
It was
on
just
that
gas
speed bump.
I think
we got it.
So all the participants were then questioned within 24 hours of their journey to the hospital. So these are the findings. 64 patients traveled over speed bumps on their way to the hospital. 54 of those, 84%, were speed bump positive. 34 of the 64 had a confirmed diagnosis of acute appendicitis in which 33, that's 97%, had worsened pain over speed bumps.
Mm.
7 patients who were speed bump positive did not have appendicitis, but they did have other significant problems such as ruptured ovarian cyst or diverticulitis. So in the end, they concluded that an increase in pain over speed bumps is associated with an increased likelihood of acute appendicitis, and it should be a key part of any doctor's questioning during diagnosis.
Huh. This is one of those ones that seems, well, first of all, I just used huh in the way that wasn't diagnosed in the previous report. But also, this is one of the ones that just seems like common sense that you wouldn't need an academic a rigorous investigation done.
Well,
but it's a good thing they did because now we know.
It's one of those where science is coming in and saying, yeah, it's like we know what's down that hallway. Do we really need science to check it? Well, yeah, we do, because you can imagine a scenario where the research would have said the opposite and said, actually, it's just willy-nilly one way or the other. This is no better than some, you know, medieval technique of questioning the humors, you know?
Yeah. That is a standard response that I pretty much always oppose when people say, like, oh, we didn't need a study to show this. This is obvious. I mean, when you say that, it just sounds like you're saying our intuitions are good enough. Our intuitions are not good enough. Our intuitions are wrong all the time. This is like what science is good for is figuring out whether or not your intuitions are correct.
Yeah. But this also gets into why this study is funny and ridiculous, because the idea of a speed bump, a lump of asphalt, serving as a diagnostic tool in diagnosing a very real and very dangerous condition, there's something just ridiculous about that. And then, of course, it all ties back into the idea that we don't have a better diagnostic system for appendicitis.
Right, yeah. Like, they don't have a way to test this other than asking them what their experience was like hitting the speed bump on the way in. Well, I wonder what, like, if models of vehicles come into play. You know, like, if you're in a Range Rover going over a speed bump versus a Dodge Challenger.
Yeah.
What, you know?
Oh, yeah, like, you know, the suspension in your car.
Sure. That would definitely be a factor, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me wonder, too, if there's if they might just create some sort of, like, funky Halloween chair that you set in the doctor's office that kind of
just
jostles
you. Does that hurt? Does that hurt?
Sit in the bump chair.
Yeah. so, I mean, it's a...
Oh, man, I can't wait for the scene in the James Bond movie where somebody, they get him to test the bump chair, but then one of the henchmen tries to kill him by turning the bump chair all the way up, like in Moonraker when they put him in the G-Force simulator.
That would be good.
But wouldn't he have to have an appendicitis for it to work?
No, he could just bump him to death.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
The sheer forces of it.
Okay.
You know what I'm talking about?
I do.
Moonraker? Where you see Roger Moore going,
I
like,
I know exactly what you mean, yeah.
I need to see that one again because
I used to
think it was the worst, but maybe it's the best because I've kind of gotten to the point in my life where I don't know that I like any of the James Bond films, so maybe I need to see the worst of them to appreciate the genre again.
I was just talking about this with a friend the other day.
I really loved
Moonraker when I was a little kid, but I don't know that it would hold up now.
All right, so there you have it. Hey, if you want to check out each of these studies in more detail, check out the landing page for this episode at stufftoblowyourmind.com. We'll make sure that there are links to related content on the website, to the How Stuff Works article about the Ig Nobel Prizes that I wrote years ago, and more to the point, links out to the specific pieces of research that are referenced here.
Yeah, and while you're there at stufftoblowyourmind.com, you can check out our blog posts, other episodes of the podcast, videos. We've got all that stuff. Plus, you know what's on stufftoblowyourmind.com? Links to all of our social media channels, such as Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, where you can find us under the handle Blow the Mind.
And if you want to email us with your feedback about the episode we recorded today or part one that we did last time, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.